guy named Michael Early, wrote something I think very helpful. He said, just clarify the ideas. Make sure you know exactly what the words mean. Make the ideas very clear. And then, using the rhythm of the verse, set those ideas in motion. And I just love that aspect of it, that they're just not ideas just sitting out there in space. Oh, this is what I mean. But you're actually sending them forward.
Hello and welcome to the State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer. Jim Elliott is away today. In the studio today, we have Dan Daly. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Garrett.
Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you could join us today. I understand that you are in the thick of a run of Henry IV, Part 1, at the Pearl Theater in New York City.
We are indeed. We began previews 5 days ago, and scheduled opening is March 3rd.
You have a long association with the Pearl Theater Company, is that correct?
I do. Been a company member there the last 15 years.
That's an extraordinary relationship.
Yeah, it is. And it's one that I'm very, very grateful to have. There are people in the resident acting company that I've been working with now for well over a decade. And the kind of trust and generosity and familiarity that is engendered when you have the opportunity to work in a company like that is truly almost impossible to put a price on. It's extraordinarily valuable, I think, both to the plays and to the audience watching it, because we're all of us of a piece, of a mind, of one mission. And that is an extraordinary thing to find in today's theater.
This play, of course, is Henry IV, Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the history plays. And when you encounter these Shakespearean plays with all of the numbers in the titles, do you think that that can be intimidating to an audience or to an actor?
It can, because the main priority from a standpoint of storytelling is to make sure that you know who all these people are. A modern audience doesn't have any idea what the political ground looked like. So you have to be very, very clear about making sure that the audience knows who is who and what side they're on.
Dan, what are some of the ways that you use to crack that nut? How do you make these characters, who are obscure at best, I think, to contemporary audiences, immediately accessible to them? Are there archetypes that are familiar?
Well, there are. One of the great things about Shakespeare as a writer is that you don't really have to dig underneath the text to find out what the character is about, who they are, what their relationship to other characters is, because Shakespeare spells it all out. Everything you need to know is right there on the page in front of you. You're given a roadmap, per se, and the process of delineating the character is a matter of investigating those signposts on the roadmap, if you will, and making sure that you're making the words reflect what is being written. You know, if a Shakespeare character says, I love you, they mean I love you. It's not like in a contemporary play where if somebody says, I love you, you have to wonder, well, are they really saying that or are they lying? You know? But the Shakespeare characters never lie unless they tell the audience first that they're going to do it. And then everybody's, yeah, they'll come down to the front of the stage and say, look, I'm going to lie to this guy now and watch what happens to him when I do. You know?
Right.
So there's that. And, you know, costumes help too. All the royals are in red tabards and all the rebels are in black or dark blue. So you got it, you know, real set. It's like a football game in that way.
The character that you're playing is, of course, Falstaff.
Yes, yes.
It has to be one of the most enjoyable characters in the entire canon to play.
Well, it's certainly a tremendous opportunity, and he reserved some of his most joyous words, Shakespeare did, for this character. As a matter of fact, he is such a symbol of joy and sensual pleasure, food, drink, sex, etc., that at least according to Harold Bloom, who wrote Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, he really calls Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, the Falstaffiad, rather than the Henryad, which is what many people call that whole sequence of four plays, Richard II up through Henry V. So he is, yes, he is a grand creation, full of life and humor and joy and love, and also full of chicanery and duplicity and cowardice, and there's just no end to the scope of his humanity.
Dan, you mentioned Harold Bloom.
Yeah.
Did you have to do a lot of reading, a lot of research to prepare for the role?
I did do a lot of research to prepare for the role, mostly to find out what other people had thought about him beforehand, because unlike most of the other characters in the play, Falstaff is fictional. At one point, he'd called him by a different name, but the depiction of the character was insulting to the family of the real named character, so he changed the name to Falstaff. So what I did was to do a lot of reading. Of course, Bloom was one of the people that I read, but just a number of other authors who have weighed in on Falstaff. There's a pun, because he's got a lot of it. And I found for the most part that everybody is in agreement that he is in many ways the antithesis in a way of Hamlet, who is all intellect, all moral passion, and Falstaff is taking you down the other road entirely. You should enjoy life. You shouldn't worry about things. You should take advantage of every situation that's going to make you feel good and enjoy it to the hilt. And you have to then find that in yourself. You know, what part of you is completely dedicated to the world of pleasure, to the world of hedonism?
If we were magically transported somehow back to the world of the play during the War of the Roses, and we were walking down the street, where would we find Falstaff and how would we recognize him?
Well, he would be by far the largest person, and I don't mean tall, although he's in my case, I'm 6'1", so he's not short. But first of all, he's just incredibly fat. I mean, I can't count the fat jokes in this play. Every time the man comes on stage, there has to be a dozen in every conceivable word you can think of to insult a fat person is leveled at him. So he is enormously fat. You would find him in a cozy tavern. Just keep looking in the cozy taverns, and you'll find him more or less in front of the fireplace holding forth.
So is this the first time you've played Falstaff himself?
No, actually, I did a different Falstaff, the one that's in Merry Wives of Windsor. And the story behind that play supposedly is that Queen Elizabeth liked the character so much in Henry IV, Part 1 and 2, she's got word to Shakespeare that she'd like to see another play with that character in it. And so he wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is more like a sitcom. The major difference between the Falstaff and Merry Wives and the one that I'm playing now is depth of intellect.
Ah.
This version of him, the one that Shakespeare originally envisioned, is really just as intelligent as Hamlet. He just has a very, very different outlook on life, one that is all about pleasure. But the depth of his ability to support that position is quite impressive.
This production of Henry IV, Part 1, marks a return to Shakespeare for you after a bit of a hiatus.
Yeah, I haven't done one. I haven't done one in 10 years. I've stayed close to him because I do read him. And of course, in my teaching positions, he comes into the classroom quite a bit with the students. So I've been able to stay in touch with him that way. But yeah, this is been a long time away, and boy, does it feel good to be back. I'm really enjoying it.
What's it like returning to Shakespeare after spending a decade in the world's contemporary theater?
Well, it's a little bit like stretching out after having been asleep for 10 hours. You know, kind of like there are joints that are saying, hell, wait a minute, you haven't used me in a while. And you go, yeah, I know, here I come. And that's true. It's true with your voice. It's true with your voice. It's true with your body and just the depth and scope of the emotions that are being discussed. It takes a couple of days to get yourself back into the fighting shape. Let's put it that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the piece that you've selected to share today.
Sure.
This is from Henry IV, Part 1, Act 4. 5, scene 1. Now, there are a lot. There are enough numbers to intimidate anyone, huh?
Yeah, that's too many numbers.
So down to the nitty-gritty. You're speaking Falstaff's words. What has just happened? Can you set the scene for us a little bit?
Absolutely. Just before he goes into the speech, he has a little exchange with his very dear friend, Prince of Wales, Pal. And he asks him, listen, if you see me down in the battle, bestride me, which means stand over me and protect me. And that would be a point of friendship. Then Hal says, only a Colossus could do that. So bestride you. So we got another fat joke in before we get to this speech. And he says, say your prayers. And that makes Falstaff think about going to bed and saying his prayers. And he says, I would 'twere bedtime and all well. I wish this were all over and we could all just crawl into bed. Then what Hal says is, well, thou owest God a death, meaning everybody's going to die someday. Thou owest God a death. And then he leaves. Falstaff is alone. 'Tis not due yet. I would be loath to pay him before his day. What should I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter. Honor pricks me on. Yea, but how if honor prick me off again when I come on? How then? Can honor set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honor hath no skill in surgery, then? No. What is honor? A word. What is in that word honor? What is that honor? Air. Trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then, yea, to the dead, but will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore I'll none of it. Honor is a mere scutcheon. And so ends my catechism.
That's marvelous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a fantastic speech, but before I ask any questions about it, I'd like to ask, why did you select this speech of all of the speeches that Falstaff has?
I think it's the one that is most emblematic of his ability to take a concept, a word, and turn it to his own philosophy. I mean, when you think about the result of what this speech means, how does it result, you know, on the battlefield? Well, it means basically he hides behind a tree and stays out of it as much as he can. And that's a terrible, cowardly thing, except for one thing. Everybody is fighting for honor and that on that field, and you can't touch it. You can't feel it. You can't grab it. It is a concept. And we know how much damage is done by people going to war and dying for concepts, right? And you have to look at that part of the argument and say, you know what? He sure is a coward, but he has a point.
It's a very profound thought. It takes it to a whole new level. When I encounter speeches like this, I think, oh, well, here's where Shakespeare is having fun. He seems to enjoy so many moments when his characters take words and ideas and make virtues out of vices or vice versa. Especially when they yank the stuffing out of supposed virtues, like when Edmund takes on the word legitimate, Parolles takes on virginity, or Henry V takes on ceremony, or Duke Vincentio takes on the word life, and twists our preconceptions, our prejudices about those words, and reverses them.
Sure, later on, when Falstaff fakes his own death to get out of fighting with Douglas, he gets up and he says, 'Twas time to counterfeit, or that hot Scot had paid me. And but then he turns right around and says, now wait a minute, I'm no counterfeit. A counterfeit is to be dead. To die is to be counterfeit. For he is the counterfeit of a man that hath not the life of a man. But to counterfeit dying in order to live is not a counterfeit, but the true and perfect image of life indeed. He said, and then he turns around to another virtue and says, well, the better part of valor is discretion. In the which better part I have saved my life. Yippee. You
know? So the speech is really about a word. How important are words to Shakespeare?
Oh my, they were obviously really important. I don't know if I've got the statistics right here, but these are the approximate numbers. You and I, or anybody else with a decent education, probably goes around with about, 3,000 words in our vocabulary that we use regularly, and Shakespeare used over 29,000. And, you know, he made up about 800, I think. And so you get a script of his and you look at the words, and the words are really everything because you go through them.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the number of words that Shakespeare uses. Mm-hmm. I looked up this word honor in the Shakespeare Concordance to find out how many times it occurs in the Shakespearean canon. And the word honor shows up 651 times. In the concordance. It's most used in Henry VIII. It occurs 43 times in Henry VIII.
Wow.
Just for fun, would you like to guess which play has the fewest occurrences of the word honor?
The one I'm doing now?
No, it's not. That would be a good answer.
No, which one?
I'll give you a hint. It's one of the comedies.
Oh, Midsummer.
There you go.
How many times does it occur there?
Only once.
My, who says it?
I don't know. That's a great question. Maybe one of our listeners can tweet that.
Right.
Back to the question at hand. And this word honor is, of course, the centerpiece of this speech.
Yeah.
How does this compare with, say, Henry V's, who is Hal in a future,
yeah,
a future mm-hmm. version of Hal? How does it compare with his Crispin's Day speech, for example, where he appeals to his men's sense of honor in order to motivate the outnumbered army on the eve of another battle? What is Shakespeare really saying about honor?
I think he's saying, and it's the thing that's, I think, kind of troubling for us as human beings, because he doesn't give us a clear answer other than to say Falstaff is right, and in Henry V, Henry is right. They're both right.
What a beautifully complex and layered relationship those two men enjoy in this play.
Mm-hmm. It
and
is.
The others.
They're a little bit like father and son. And yet they're also two friends, the best kind of friends, who challenge one another, who are almost equal matches in a game of wits. I say almost because I know Falstaff's a little better than Hal. At least I think so. But we're good opponents when it comes to a game of wits. So yeah, it's a wonderful relationship that's like a father and son, but also tremendously dear friends.
And for those that are familiar with the play, it just heightens the tragic sense of loss that occurs as their relationship progresses.
Yeah. At the end of part one, you can see that one day they will have to go their separate ways, but not yet. Not yet.
One of the things that I notice about this speech is, well, of course, it's prose. It isn't written in verse.
Right, right.
Does Falstaff speak in verse?
Only when he's imitating King Henry, or in the presence of royalty. He has one line as himself that is in iambic pentameter. Worcester, the head of the rebels, says, "I didn't seek this day of discord." And the king says, "Well, how comes it then?" And Falstaff mutters, "Well, rebellion lay in his way, and he found it." It's like, and then he gets shut up by the prince immediately after that. Prince says, "Peace, Jewett, peace." You know. So if he's in the presence of royalty, yes, he can speak in pentameter, but the rest of the play is entirely in prose. And I don't mind telling you, that's a little bit harder to tackle, because when you've got the rhythm of iambic pentameter, sometimes memorization slips down real easily. But when you've got prose and you've got these long, complicated sentences with a lot of supporting clauses and shifts and jumps and twists, it's a bigger beast to tame.
What about the rhetorical structure of this speech? Rhetorical is it? I don't mean that as a pun, but it is kind of a pun. There are, I counted them, I think there are 15 rhetorical questions.
Yes.
In the speech. Now, how do you handle that?
Well, actually, I don't know how many of them are rhetorical, to be honest with you, because at the end, he says, "And so ends my catechism." Now, as a small boy being brought up in a Catholic household, I went to Catholic school and we had catechisms. And these books were all question and answer structures. And so Falstaff, in that speech, is putting questions out there, and at least this is my effort with it, I'm risking that somebody in the audience might have an answer. I'm really asking the question.
So you're actually inviting the audience to participate in the catechism with you.
Yeah, I hope they don't. But I think it's really important that he go through the process of this catechism just like a first grader in Catholic school going through the first day of catechism and asking these questions and then getting an answer. So they're not really rhetorical, even though they're ridiculous. I mean, if you look at it on the face of it, I mean, of course, honor cannot set to a leg. It has no skill in surgery. But if you really ask the question as if there might be a yes answer, it puts pressure on people who regard honor as, a given fact, that it shouldn't be tested, it shouldn't be questioned, it shouldn't be examined. You buckle up your helmet and you go out there and you fight for your country or fight for your religion or fight for whatever it is. Yeah, and Falstaff is saying, wait a minute, hold on.
So do you think that he's actually going through this catechism because he needs to ferret out an answer that's of grave importance to him? Or is he going through this catechism because he's lampooning catechism itself in order to make a clever point?
No, he needs to do this for himself because he's just been told by the best friend he has in Prince Hal that he owes God a death and that he should say his prayers and go into battle and essentially be honorable. And before he starts the whole catechism, the last thing he says is, well, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whether death is due today or not. Honor pricks me on. And in the case of our production, I actually start to walk off as if, I guess that's it. I guess this is what I'm going to have to do. Honor pricks me on. Everybody is here for honor. We're all going, okay, let's, wait a minute. But how if honor prick me off? Meaning, what if I die for honor? What does it do for me then? Or what if I get hurt? What does honor do for me then? He wants to stay out of the fray. That's what he doesn't want to die. Some of these, listen to Hotspur. Hotspur says, doomsday is here. Die all. Die for one. And, then people go, really? Like, you're really ready to die? Douglas says to him, he says, don't talk of dying. I'm in this battle to win. when your leader gets into that, boys, we're probably all going to die today, and da-da-da-da-da, somebody's got to be sitting there thinking, hey, wait a minute. Really? You're kind of settled up on this now? I'm not, And I think that's what Falstaff comes to, but he has to find a way to justify it, just as he has to find a way to justify playing dead on the battlefield. And he does. He figures out a way to do it.
At the conclusion of this speech, he says, therefore, I'll none of it.
Yeah.
Honor is a mere scutcheon.
Mm-hmm.
What's a scutcheon?
A scutcheon is like a little coat of arms or symbol of your family that they might put on your casket, okay? or a little coat of arms or something like that.
A trinket?
A symbol.
Symbol.
It's a symbol of your family, of your clan, of your, you know, your county or whatever. And so Falstaff says that's all it is. That's all it is. It's just a symbol. It's nothing else.
Dan Daly, it has been a fantastic experience talking with you. I wish you the best of luck with this production of Henry IV, Part 1.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too.
When is it opening again?
The official opening is March 3rd, and we run straight through March 17th.
Break legs.
Thank you, Garrett.
And thank you for being our guest on The State of Shakespeare.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for asking.
And listeners, thank you for listening. I'm Garrett Vandermeer, and this is The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.